Hello and welcome. My name's Jo Frost and here with my co-host Peter Linus, this is Being Human. Welcome back to season five, Peter.
It is hard to believe that we have made it to season five. And thank you all for joining us as we explore what does it mean to be human in 2024.
Yes, indeed. I keep having to like double check myself going, no, surely it can't be, but it is. We are having fun at life. What are you up to at the moment? Where have you been? What's going on in the world of Peter Linus?
I've been traveling quite a bit, both for work and outside of work. That's been fantastic. And of course, we've got a book out since the last time. We've done the videos. We've been really engaged in the Being Human project. So that's also been keeping me super busy and us super busy. So yeah, lots in life and lots in work.
Indeed, indeed. I'm just not very good at twiddling our thumbs. Kids are just getting bigger. Life is getting more hectic. Work is fun, but definitely keeps myself occupied. And yes, book comes out, video series done, podcast is out again. There's plenty to keep us out of mischief, shall we say.
Yeah, yeah, to achieve something, just when you think it's done, you're like, yes, but you have to go and do this. You have to go and talk about it. You have to get out there. You have to do the next thing. So it never stops.
Never stops, indeed. Okay, so what are we looking to achieve this season? Why are we back again?
Man, I have no idea. What are we doing? We are looking to take some issues, the things that we are spotting that are going on in the world around us, and take the lens. So we've talked about the lens, we've unpacked it, we've done the kind of theory, and now we're saying, okay, let's take an issue, let's find something going on and kind of put it through the lens. Let's look at it through the lens, put that thing in the center and say, right, what does it mean to be human when we look at an election, when we look at social media, when we look at immigration, whatever's going on in the world, that we want to actually look at it through the lens and try and put this stuff into practice.
Indeed, because all of the conversations that we've had around what does it mean to be human, being human in this time and in this season, we have used this kind of analogy of a lens. What does it mean to look through something, and how does that shape and form the world that we encounter? How does it shape and form who we sense that we are and the world in which we inhabit? So you and I have come up with the being human lens. It has four parts, these kind of four core aspects of our humanity. And we're going to pop different topics into its focal point so that we're going to view elections, immigration, climate change, racial justice, any of the sort of hot topics that are coming up in our world. We're going to use the focal point to ask a question: how does this form and shape our humanity? And how does our humanity form and shape how we engage with these topics? So it's going to be quite fun. I'm enjoying going back to our roots and you and I just pontificating and putting the world to rights. So it's going to be an entertaining season, I hope.
Yeah, so we've been arguing, debating, discussing what we're going to do. And what have we concluded we're going to start with in this episode?
Well, we thought we'd go for the really easy option of kicking off a conversation around elections, democracy, and the rise of nationalism or populism. Because this year's a mental year. There are about 4 billion people going to the polls in some form or another around the globe. So that is a lot of democratic engagement, but also a lot of conversations and a lot of shaping of the world that we will inhabit once these elections have taken place.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, democracy itself is kind of maybe not up for grabs as too much, but it's being talked about a lot more. It's being kind of contested and pushed around. Is it a good thing? What does it look like? What should it look like? And so a number of stories caught our eye on this. I mean, the year started and a number of the kind of magazines and comment pieces were around these elections, with Taiwan kicking off. It had the first elections, I think, back on 13th of January. It's a tiny set of islands, but its population 23 million people, but it's only 100 miles from China. And therein lies the kind of key pinch point, and has a very complex piece of history with China. Was part of China, was where those who were running China kind of escaped to during some of the stuff in the past. And they've got this one China policy. Is this part of China or is it not? And it's probably the place where you could see the world's superpowers at play, potentially with the US and China engaging in a little bit of a proxy diplomacy, proxy battling, proxy everything. So that was the first election that kicked things off, and the kind of democratic side, William Lai, won that election, and China aren't happy. There's the start point.
So we've got Taiwan. Go on, what?
Didn't Maverick have a Taiwanese flag on the back of his jacket, and that was why it couldn't go into China? They had to change it and edit it out. Wasn't that something, just to keep it like culturally relevant too? The Maverick movie, as in Tom Cruise, had his leather jacket with a Taiwan flag. But if you had that, you couldn't produce it in China. So that's, sorry. Just going back on that.
Sure. Great. Thanks for that.
Oh, sidetracked, yeah.
So probably the biggest election that most people are aware of, at least who's fighting it and who's up, is the US election that will be happening in November. The rematch, as it is known, from 2020, Trump versus Biden. I think, it's safe to say that most people aren't particularly happy about that option.
Oh, listen, I know. So divisive, so intriguing, but ultimately so important that you have two nigh on 80-year-olds battling it out to lead what is allegedly the world's largest democracy, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, depends on your views on India and China. Both of which, India is also coming up because it's a massive election too, which is...
I can't get my head around this election. It's going to run for 6 weeks.
Well, there's 968 million eligible voters.
Which is fair. But like in the UK, you have a kind of media blackout when the polls are open so that the media doesn't influence people's voting. You can't have a media blackout for 6 weeks. So it is a fascinating idea that you have polls open for such a long space of time that public opinion can shift. If you vote at the beginning versus voting at the end, there can be quite a seismic travel, surely. Oh.
Yeah, everything in the scale in India is just insane to kind of get our heads around. And Modi, who is the current prime minister, is running a pretty nationalist agenda there, very strong pro-India kind of agenda with the BJP party. And again, that's proving pretty divisive. Recent legislation to basically anti-Muslim legislation, which proves incredibly popular with his constituency. But to do so, as in many other places, is a divisive tool that is used to mobilise one part of the electorate.
And I think that's probably the word we're going to be using for most of today, is this idea that elections are increasingly divisive. It is pitting one or a number of different visions of an area against each other and kind of exacerbating that conversation on which vision wins, who gets to have the say and the power. So that's the conversation in the UK. We, at some point this year, will be going to the polls.
November.
Yes. You reckon?
I'm putting my money. Yeah, I'm marking the card. I'm going for a November election. But as you say, building a broad coalition is proving more and more difficult because democracy is generally based upon building a much wider group of people because there's so many issues that people are interested in. You have to build broader coalitions, but that has become incredibly difficult. We've seen a very divisive, again, by-election with George Galloway in Rochdale, the Workers' Party of Britain. Basically, Gaza was the divisive or the defining issue there, and he won. He's held seats in four different constituencies because he's a kind of guy who drops into somewhere contested in a by-election and pops up and sometimes wins it. And Lee Anderson has defected from the Conservatives to Reform UK, being their first MP. Again, that was because he refused to apologise for calling Sadiq Khan, saying Islamists had got control of Sadiq Khan. So you see, again, very similar topic, moving two different ways there, in a sense, and being very divisive to the mainstream parties in the UK, and both Labour and the Conservatives suffering here, as somebody's gone to the more extreme version of their positions, if you like, and won the vote, at least temporarily. Indeed. Or not won a vote in Lee Anderson's case, just defected.
Yeah, and both remains to be seen as to whether or not they keep their seats when it comes to a national poll. So that would be why we want to talk about elections and democracy and how it forms and shapes our sense of humanity and our being in the world. We are using the Being Human lens to do that. Peter, do you want to give people a whistle-stop tour of what the lens is and how it works?
No doubt everybody's read the book and they've listened to previous episodes of the podcast, so they all already know. But on the off chance that you're the new person listening in, so we have the lens. We're going to, as you were saying earlier, Joe, we're going to put democracy in this case and elections right at the center of that. So at the top of the lens, we have significance, who matters? And these elections are really asking that question, you know, who matters? Questions around identity, around nationalism. So that drives us into the who matters question. Then secondly, we have connection around relationships. We matter to each other. These elections, as we said, are deeply divisive. There's fear, there's protectionism coming into the agenda. They often divide camps to try and then mobilize a different section of the electorate. So we're concerned about how that, the kind of fracturing that goes on in connection. And having done the first two, I'm getting you ready. You're going to deal with the other two. So that was significance and connection. Talk us through presence and participation.
So indeed. So at the bottom, we talk about this idea that to be human is to be present. So being here and now matters. So this sense of place, the idea that actually all of these elections are in a space, rooted in a community. They're physically important. So what does it mean to be present? And then finally, this idea of participation. Democracy in and of itself is a participatory act. We do something and your act makes a difference, unless, of course, it's a kind of sham election, but that's a different conversation. But that is it. The difference we make in the world matters. And so how does engaging in some of these political conversations and democracy in and of itself, how does our understanding of what it means to be human affect that? And how are we affected by the democratic process? So that's the kind of idea. We want to use the lens to help shape and form and inform our understanding of some of these issues as they're bubbling up in our world. So, Peter, we're going to start at the top. Significance, who matters? What do you see in this conversation around the issue of significance?
Yeah, so we're always looking for where's the cultural hook point to get into the conversation. So I was intrigued, something we haven't mentioned yet, Israel-Palestine, but it's a backdrop to a number of these elections. Well, I suppose we touched upon it with George Galloway. The kind of prisoner hostage swap situation that's gone on a few times throughout this conflict. And the ratios intrigued me was one of the first things. So it tends to be 10 Palestinian prisoners for one Israeli hostage. And I'm not sure how those have come to be, but that's an interesting enough ratio. Even in our reporting of it, it's how many people have been killed on each side. And there's almost an equating of the numbers of deaths and are these lives worth the same amount and how they're being reported. It constantly intrigued me. So the 10-1 ratio on a prisoner swap was really bizarre. Like, How does somebody come up with that? How does somebody say that one life is worth more than another? Who even agrees to that? What's being conveyed about that? That was the first thing that caught my eye on the who matters.
That is interesting, though, because it would imply equally that we have been quite captured by the story of the hostages being taken on October 7th and the violence and the horror of that event. But equally, the Palestinian prisoners and those who are being held by Israel are obviously, if there's a 10-1 ratio, there are so many people in prison. And yet we don't hear that story. It is what happened on October 7th that elevated the conversation because the conflict brought it to light. So how much have we tolerated in terms of the Palestinian struggle up until this point in order for us to be at a 10-1 ratio today?
Well, and I think so interesting. You said equally and then kind of corrected yourself to also, because this is, that's the question, is it equally? And yeah. So if you want to split a room, even a room of people who agree, a room of Christians, we could go to a room of church leaders or Christians, and you could split a room on this issue as to where they go on Israel-Palestine, because so much of it is framed again by a set of lenses, pre-existing lenses that we have. We have ideas, because the reality is we don't know all that's happening on the ground. We can't equate everything and we can't make all these decisions. So again, we often have a lens into this conversation that predisposes us to one side or the other in this conflict. And I think that's one of the things we kind of want to challenge and go after and say, what's going on here? So while that's hugely divisive in and of itself, and people have views listening, we're not trying to resolve that conflict, because straight away, again, I thought of, like in the US election, we're going to see abortion's going to be a hugely important issue. The overturning of the kind of court decision in Roe versus Wade, or the pushing that down to the local kind of courts and states to decide, is sitting as a subtext to the US election. And from my perspective, both candidates have very strange sets of views on that, frankly. So you have a Catholic sitting president, Joe Biden, who's fairly overtly pro-abortion. You have Donald Trump saying he's against it, but actually then when you push, almost every time he qualifies that in some way, and has extremely challenging views on a whole set of other issues for me. So I'm somebody who's ardently pro-life, but find both candidates' positions on this really troubling, and also the whole way in which the issues become so divisive in the US. So, you know, and I'm aware of commenting as an outsider, so you know, we work here in the UK on that issue, and much more intrigued in terms of some of the complexities of UK legislation. But again, what we're really noting at this stage is just how divisive it is and how little substance seems to be being played to the fundamental question of who matters in the conversation.
And it seems as if in these political conversations, one set of people's significance is elevated above another set of people. And that's the key issue. Who has the most significance? Who has the most value in this conversation? Who needs to be taken the most seriously? Because it is a zero-sum game. If one person gets it, another person loses it. And there are winners and losers in the democratic process. And that in and of itself is problematic when we're looking at this idea of humanity.
And the question we're trying to ask is, look, I guess we could talk about this now all day, is on an issue around nationalism, on issues around identity politics, on issues where our politicians are tending to lead to divisiveness, how do we as Christians navigate that? We saw a little bit of this in the Scottish referendum a number of years ago, Christians taking both sides in that, and trying to work out how do we as churches, as Christian leaders, as people within that community who's saying our primary identity is in Christ, recognize fairly fundamental disagreements about some of these key ideas in terms of nationalism, in terms of identity politics, in terms of Israel-Palestine. So what does it mean for us to live into the better story? What does it mean for us to say our primary identity is in Christ? I recognize somebody else's brother and sister in Christ who takes a fundamentally different view on some of these stories. And then how does that affect our politics and the ways in which we choose to engage with one another? Doing that respectfully, doing that in ways that still say, I fundamentally disagree with you, but actually there's something that transcends in this moment and it cuts across. And how do I begin to be challenged about the significance of, be it Israeli or Palestinian lives in this moment, be it the lives of the mother or the unborn child, be it the lives of those who take very different political views than me, how do I do that well?
I think that's such a good challenge, isn't it? Because even we feel the toxicity, even talking about some of the actors in this space, whether it's Trump or Biden, Galloway, Lee Anderson, Keir Starmer, Rishi Sunak, we turn them into characters as opposed to recognizing that they are people. They are image bearers. They have significance. Refusing to allow our conversation and our view of people that we may disagree with to dehumanize them is in and of itself a countercultural act. And it hopefully, as you say, is living that better story.
And one of the things I think we might return to this, and we've talked a little bit about it, I suppose, in an era of cancel culture and in this moment, is there's so little space for grace and forgiveness in some of the conversations. And if we can't model that as Christians, then we're in trouble, because it's a culture that hasn't, it struggles with the language of forgiveness, struggles with saying something's wrong, or where, you know, because we've no language of sin. We want to get rid of Easter and the cross. We want to get rid of the place of forgiveness and repentance. So a lot of those ideas are missing. So when we can say sorry, when we can say we forgive another, when we can extend grace to somebody with a different view, those are things that are going to mark us out differently in some of the public engagement around this. And our part of our witness in this moment as to what it is to recognize the significance of another.
So after the break, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about our connection, the fact that we matter to each other. We'll be back in a moment. Okay, welcome back. We are looking at elections and nationalism and populism. We've looked at this idea that we are significant, we matter. Next up, connection.
Yes. So what is the impact of connection on elections and democracy and this process? Joe, tell us all.
Yeah, I think that the idea of democracy in and of itself is recognizing the fact that we all have a connectivity with each other. We are in some way connected. We are a constituency. We are a space. We are a community that come together and collectively decide what are we going to look like in this next upcoming season. We matter to each other. And everybody is supposedly equal. One person, one vote. Everybody gets a say. But in that, it's also quite individualistic. I am voting for what I think is right. You're voting for what you think is right. And the biggest set of people that agree, they get to win. And certainly in the UK's election, it is quite a winner-takes-all system. So first past the post, whoever gets the majority first wins the right to form a government. And it's their vision, their mandate to move forward. So it is in and of itself inherently divisive. And so the question is, what does that do to our sense of each other? And how do you handle the other in some of these democratic conversations?
Yeah, and I'm really interested in some of the social media feeds. We've got the filter bubble ideas that we only get a certain set of stories that reinforces our ideas, and then it becomes harder to build coalitions to reach bipartisan consensus often in the States they talk about. Because it's really easy to say, I believe this and I want this, but only 20-30% of the population probably want each of the issues, and we are going to end up voting for a slate of issues, not all of which reflect who we are or what we want. You can't have referendum on every single issue. And even if you did have that way of doing it, the Swiss are kind of closer to that. Fundamentally, you won't always be in the majority. So we're always going to have to make some sort of compromise. And compromise is usually seen as a difficult, or maybe even dirty word for Christians. But the reality was Daniel lived in a world in which he had to make compromises with the state that didn't agree with his position. It was fundamentally opposed to his position, but he worked within that state system. So, I mean, there's somebody we might turn to look at and think about. But I think that idea of coalition, single issue, gets really easy. Like, well, I believe this and I want this for myself. But when we start to think of the other and we have to build some sort of consensus beyond ourselves, that is actually really difficult. And we're seeing that at society-wide level. And that's causing a lot of the fracturing of relationships. So it's really easy to get in a group of 10 people who agree with you. But we have to govern in the UK for 65 million people, in the US for 300 and something million people, in India for 968 million voters.
Yeah. And I think that is, for me, the fascinating thing, that you can have this idea of, yeah, we all want to see our space or our country or our constituency flourish, but it's asking people to put their needs second is often a step too far. So I live just off Junction 10 of the M25, which has hit the headlines recently, because for the first time ever in March, the M25 closed. since its opening so that they could build a new bridge or knock something down or whatever. And I didn't know that I lived on the busiest junction of the motorway in the UK. Now I do, because they closed it. And the problem is that that section of road is the only way to get from Heathrow into London. And it is the only way to get from Gatwick, our two major national hub airports, into London or around the country, because there are no good A roads or side roads around. And it's because in that area, everyone's like, yes, I hate the traffic, but not enough to put an extra road in my backyard. It is the ultimate not in my backyard area. And so they're refusing to put any other kind of systems or processes. So we know that there's a problem, but nobody is prepared to take the yes in my backyard step. So we know we're connected. We know some of us need to compromise. Some of us need to say, I'm going to put other people's needs first. But in this kind of culture, that voice is really quiet. When do I say, fine, I'll suffer, I will take the hit here for the sake of other people? And that connectivity in our democratic process feels very quiet at the moment.
Yes. And so again, we probably could identify the cultural problems and cultural hooks ad nauseum. But again, for us, we're saying, like, this is the reality of sin and living in a fallen world. Fractured relationships are right there in the first pages of Genesis. We know that that's what happens. So in one sense, that puts us a step ahead in identifying some of the problem and being alert to that. But the restoration of relationships is also the absolute heart of the gospel message. And so I suppose the question, the challenge for us, what's the better story that we want to tell around connection? How do we live into that space, aware of what the problem is? And I think that is a really important step, to be able to name that in our culture to some degree, but also to take the lead as Christians in looking at what reconciled and restored relationships look like.
And I think that, again, gets me really excited that we do have a better story for connectivity and mattering to each other in our world. So the EA recently did some polling on voting motivations and how Christians were considering the political landscape that we're in at the moment. And we're asked, when it comes to voting, what is your primary motivation? What's the decision-making factor that makes you pick one party or one MP over another? And the majority, the overwhelming majority of people saying that when it comes to their voting motivation, it is how will their party benefit other people is their primary motivation. And our lowest motivation is how will this affect me and my family? And I think that is such a, again, a countercultural storyline in this space. I am going to use my vote to benefit other people, especially those in need. I am not going to use my vote to benefit me and my family. And in this day and age, the what about me-ism needs a better story. And Christians do get to live that story. And that's really encouraging.
It is. And actually, another piece of polling we did in Northern Ireland for the election was also about the one of the places where the church was distinctive from the culture in its voting intentions was about the welcome of asylum seekers. They were much more welcoming, I think at about 80, 82% or something of Christians thought it was very important to welcome, versus about 50% in the general population, which is counter what maybe some people might think, and a really important story to make sure we're telling. Well, we are more welcoming as a people, and that's something we want to talk about. So that is significance, and that is connection, which turns us to the third down the bottom of our lens, because we often think of this visual image that we have of presence and the importance of place. And I suppose the kind of fundamental question I want to tease out a little bit here is, does place have a positive role to play in our thinking about elections and democracy and our role in a democratic society in which most of us are living in? How important is it? Because I guess there's two broad sweeps here. One is, oh, it's this kind of negative nationalism that's on the rise in one sense, but also how do we wrestle with immigration and the movement of people on another? And is there a place to say, well, actually, place is important? It's easy to kind of dish on nationalism, I think. And there are aspects of that I'd like to challenge. But I also think there's a positive aspect to it. I'm somebody who lives in that strange part of the world called Northern Ireland. I just traveled again recently to Geneva and to Switzerland. And I really, really wished I had my had an Irish or EU passport, because you get to move through things much quicker and can travel on both those passports, hold both and more identities. I describe myself as Northern Irish, Irish, British, European, all of the above, I have no problem with. But I am deeply rooted in the sense of place of being from Northern Ireland and have the funny accent that goes with that and love that. And I'm excited about that. And I met people, and as soon as I say I'm from Ireland, and nearly always say that I'm Irish when I'm traveling, American couple straight in, we've been here, we've been there, my family's from there, and boom, the conversation just opens, because place is so important to so many people. But how does that affect our voting intentions and our engagement?
I think you are absolutely right. We have seen the negative conversations around populism and nationalism make America great again. The kind of America first idea. You've got the Indian nationalism that's been rising with Modi. You've got Brexit, Frexit, and all the other kind of exits around. And actually, what does that rise of nationalism do in some of our political spaces? But why is that storyline so powerful and persuasive to people? It's because our sense of place is so deeply important. Where you live and where you are from matters deeply to our sense of self. It is how we inhabit the world.
Yeah. And so the Lee Anderson knows that when he says Sadiq Khan is being run by the Islamists, he won't apologize for that, because he knows that plays to a certain constituency. And George Galloway will run hard in his pro-Gaza statements in the constituency he's in, because he knows that, that will work and that will get people out to vote. That's the negative side. And yet when you talk again to people in Scotland, Wales, Northern, lots of different countries, I suppose English nationalism possibly has the hardest, I think, needle to thread there. Because most of those other countries, language and place and story are incredibly important and are seen as broadly positive ideas. Again, hugely contested, with a very violent edge in my own context. And I suppose it's one that we probably try to navigate. I'm not saying we're ahead of the curve, because we've gone through a very painful journey on that. But over the years have wrestled with identity politics, with wrestled with where that goes violent and how tribal and negative that becomes, but also how you have to push forward on that. Now, we're on a peace process that is still processing for sure. So I'm not saying we're there by any stretch, but we've had to wrestle with how identity plays a huge role, including religious identity, because we look to somewhere like the States where Christian nationalism is on the rise. And it is a cause of concern for me. And I guess some of our listeners might be split on that. I'm not saying it's all bad, but how it's portrayed, how it is linked, and some of the edges of that do feel deeply problematic. The idea of just pulling biblical ideals in and just dropping them into the national set of laws. Some of those ideas aren't going to work. Some of those are exclusive to Christians. We are called to a different way of living and not to impose those on everybody. There are rules that are just good for being human that I think we should have on everybody. Thou shalt not kill. Like, let's take the basics on that. There's some of the freedom rules that were put in place in Exodus that are really positive for the whole of society. And then there are rules about giving 10% of your income, take an obvious one, to the church, that are for us as Christians. That's what we as Christians do, and our drive to help the other and to give charitably. Those are things that we are told to do then because we follow Jesus, and go beyond that. We can't impose those on everybody else. So I think there is a real challenge. For me personally, I'm still wrestling with how multiculturalism and how we do that well. What is it that's distinctive about a place that we need to honor and respect? And what is it that we learn from other cultures and bring in while holding those two? I think there is a bit of a tension, and I think we're still navigating that as Christians and as a society. Rootedness and stability are good, but not static. We're not talking about no movement here. So how do we honor that God put us into people groups, but also that we are able to move and we are able to share and we are able to be hospitable and to welcome others in? And we, in fact, are told to welcome the refugee into our place. But in a world of mass migration, that's not the same as welcoming I don't think that command for me is the same as welcome everybody. And there are limits to what's possible in an area to welcome in the kind of levels of migration that we're seeing in this moment. And some of that is being orchestrated. And we might talk about that in future episodes, about how that's being used almost as a weapon. The movement of people is huge and really difficult to wrestle with.
Yeah, Yeah. And I love the honesty there of we're still trying to work this out. Where are the boundaries of being rooted in a place and yet also being part of a shared humanity and a commonality there? I suppose for me, I want to hold two things together. One, that my citizenship is in heaven, and actually that is my primary sense of place, is actually it isn't about here. It is recognizing that actually I am a citizen of a different kingdom, and therefore an ambassadorial role within my sense of self and my sense of place. But simultaneously, as an ambassador, I carry the Jeremiah mandate of seek the welfare of the city. So in other words, wherever I am sent, wherever I am rooted, that place, I should be motivated to see that place flourish and the community in that place flourish. And holding those two things together, I think, starts to give a narrative of, a better story of what it means to be present in a place, in a season, in a time, in a community, but part of something more global and more holistic.
Yeah, that's so good, that Jeremiah piece, the shalom of the shalom, the dynamic, vibrating health of a society, the thriving and the fullness of the place in which we are in. And again, remember, they're in exile. It's a culture that's alien to them, anathema to them, against them, and yet they're told to put down roots, to marry and have kids, to build their buildings and really get involved. Really good. So we've done significance, we've done connection, we've done presence. The final part of the lens, Joe, is participation. What are we thinking when we come to elections and participation? Is it just that we vote? Is that it?
Well, and even, are people even turning up to the polls? The idea that to be in a democratic space is to participate, and yet how few people actually do turn up and vote, and how toxic have our political conversations got, so that people just go, I've got nobody to vote for. My vote doesn't matter. It doesn't make a difference. My voice doesn't count. And so the kind of stuff it, I'm out, is becoming more and more prevalent. So that difference that somebody does make is becoming muted. There is a reason why there is a triple lock on pensions, and why we have built-in discrimination on age. If you're under, what is it, 21 or 25, you get paid less money. And it's because the under 25s don't turn up to vote. So politicians aren't nervous about people taking their seats away because they're not going to raise their voice. That participation piece is becoming more and more fractious as people say, there is nobody here to represent me. I will not participate. And what does that do?
So I'm pretty sure you did make up a new word there with fractious. I think you combined anxious and fractious, which is genius. So, but it's great. Let's go with it. Fractious, that's a new word you've heard created today for this podcast. But yeah, participation, we often think at the higher level. So we, like the big election, and I think we do need to participate. And again, I will say, as a kind of political nerd and somebody's really interested, I find it really hard voting sometimes, but there are also multiple layers and levels to this in terms of, yes, you've got Westminster here in the UK, but you'll have local elections, you've got council elections, you've got right down to the school board and the governors and things. But we've said before, so often this is also where you can participate and actually have influence on your local school, in your local street, in your local council area. And one of the things I really want to say to people, it is really easy to be critical of Christians or people who say they're Christians or people of faith backgrounds who are going to stand in these situations. And it is so hard, the kind of decisions that they have to face. I likewise will disagree with some of what they do. Sometimes we may even comment publicly, but we aim to be so careful around that because it is so difficult to navigate this moment. So one of the things I'd say, one practical thing is, please do pray for anybody who tries to take a stand on these issues and get into the front line. It is tough, and maybe give them an extra dose of grace and mercy at those moments, because the kind of levels of decisions, the levels of expectations, the pushback, the text, the hate speech, the kind of tweet, the stuff they get is like ridiculous, and it is so hard for anybody to realistically do that. So one aspect of participation is to just be, one, to go for it, but two, to pray for anybody who has the nerve to try and do that. That's not to say they're doing it right and they get a kind of free pass to challenge, but just really think through what they're probably having to process to do it.
Yeah. I remember Parliament was in a mess over some of the Brexit stuff, and the votes were going on, and the name calling and scum being shouted across the aisle, and it was awful. And I remember just sort of watching the parliamentary debates, and it was really late, and it was really ugly a few years ago. And I was just I dropped my MP an email. It was like 10:30 at night, and I'm not her biggest fan. She and I disagree on quite a lot of issues, but I was like, I just want you to know that thank you for being my MP. Thank you for showing up. I'm praying for you. I know that this must be really hard. And I want you to know that I'm praying for you. She emailed me back 20 minutes later to say thank you. So, trust me, she has never contacted me so quickly. There's not many other issues, but you just go, you're a human being. You are showing up. You are getting involved. You are being shouted at by left and right. My goodness, how quickly we forget the humanity of the person in that space. Pray for our leaders. Pray for the people, the responsibility that they carry. They have to be the grown-ups in the room. They're looking around going, who's going to make this call? They are. They're the ones to make the call. That is a heavy burden to carry. Even when we disagree with them, we can pray for them. That is so important.
Yeah, I think that they're human beings is just the point. Like there are all sorts of office systems and setups, and there's big political networks and some things, but actually every single one of them comes down to an individual MP. They may be a government minister, they might even be the prime minister, but they're still human beings. And a lot of stuff, particularly for your regular MP, does come through directly to them, or they get sight of it at some point. And so a simple email, a simple encouragement, a simple I'm praying for you, it's remarkable the impact it's had. And we've had a number of stories around that, and we've been involved in little kind of moves to try and do things around that. Like there are, of course, power structures at work that we need to be alert to, we need to be praying into, we need to be thinking about. But we also have incredible freedom in how we respond. It's one of the things we want to say in participation. Like we as human beings do have this freedom to engage in various ways, and we are responsible for the ways that we do that. We have to take personal responsibility and accountability as we engage. And I suppose that's leading us, to those some practical things we absolutely want to land on in this moment. A few points for that. One is probably to say one of the practices we have in the book is around digital abstinence, sort of fasting and coming away from social media. That's not for everybody, but for some people during elections, there's a good reason why there's a 6-week kind of block out for any organizations around elections that they can't say something, because people tend to say things that aren't that wise and aren't that great. That might be a thing that some of us need to practice, that we find these things just too much. We're too involved, or we're too susceptible, or we're too whatever. And so digital absence might be a good thing for us. That might just be a day a week just to get away from it. It might be over the period around that election or coming up to it. So again, we're not saying that's for everyone. I'll probably be engaged. I like politics and want to be. But as an organization, we and all our staff have to be super careful not to be party political during that window. That's maybe a good practice for everybody to think about, like how do we just really navigate it well? So digital abstinence might be one of the things we need to do in this season. Joe, what else could we be thinking about?
I think it's so key, isn't it? Because we are part of these stories, but these stories come with habits. They come with practices. And if we want to live a better story, we've got to have some better habits. And some of that is just being quiet and not allowing some of those stories and some of that toxicity and some of that shouting to form and shape us. We've already touched on one, and that is the intercession, that the government of the whole world rests upon the shoulders of the King of Kings. Yeah. And if we are concerned about the political landscape, if we're concerned about our democratic base, how much more concerned is the one whose image we bear? So the importance to bring our political landscape, our political questions, our political engagement as an active inter to the King of Kings is so key. Are we praying? Are we on our knees asking God's kingdom to come in our place, in our communities, in our lives? And are we stepping up and saying, send me, put it in my backyard, let my voice speak out for justice and for peace, to elevate the voice of the others? How much are we actually acting and standing in that gap as an act of intercession and praying on behalf of the communities that we are a part of? And then finally, the physical embodiment of that is hospitality. How do we host? How do we welcome? How do we extend our space to include and welcome others in a divisive conversation around democracy? To be hospitable is probably the most countercultural act we can do. So let's live that better story and be hospitable to those around us.
Yeah, and I totally agree. It should be physical. If at all possible, it's inviting somebody from a different perspective. But your first step might actually be to recognize you're being played and to read and engage in media from a different perspective, or to just start that journey. Like if you're a Telegraph reader, read The Guardian. If you're a Guardian reader, read The Telegraph. You know that they are sending you a certain set of agendas. That's just what they do. So start those moves, but preferably and ideally get engaged with people who think differently than you do and begin to understand them. Because we're sent a kind of typecast and a caricature often of what the other side think, and everything's divided into other sides. And then when your other side is your friend who you're standing beside, preferably in church or at a football match or just going across the street and meeting, it just feels so different to engage in that way in the real human interaction that we want to see people do.
So get out there, live that better story, show people what it means to be human in this season and in this place. If you want to dig into some of these ideas a little bit more, obviously, you can buy our book, Being Human, at all major retailers. And you can check out some of our thinking, some of the conversations, and some of the other resources that we have on beinghumanlens.com. But until next time, take care. God bless. Thank you.